This episode is brought to you by C90 Ocean Minerals, the first step in regenerative agriculture. C90 offers a complete spectrum of organic minerals and trace elements that feed soil bacteria and fungi to regenerate your soil matrix and improve soil fertility. Soil with improved microbiology and mineral nutrition will grow protein-packed and nutrient-rich pastures that your animals will thrive on and yield more productive row crops and produce. Plus, their premium mineral salt offers 5 times the valuable minerals and trace elements versus leading competitors. Give them a call at 717-580-1458, and their experts will develop a custom program that fits your operation. Or visit their website to order smaller quantities, including for your garden. Learn more at c-90.com. That's sea-90.com. Or give them a call at 717-580-1458. From Acres USA, you're listening to Tractor Time, a conversational podcast where we'll explore sustainable farming, regenerative practices, and the latest innovations in eco-agriculture with some of your favorite farmers and ranchers. I'm your host, Sarah Wenzel-Fisher, the Executive Director of the Kavira Coalition. Welcome to Tractor Time. Today we're talking with Kelly Mulville. Kelly is the vineyard director at Piscinas Ranch, where he has spent nearly a decade working to establish a functioning and productive vineyard through holistic design. For the past 25 years, Kelly has managed and consulted with vineyards, farms, and ranches throughout the Western U.S., Spain, and Australia. He focuses on combining farming and viticulture with holistic management in order to design and manage in more ecologically, socially, and economically sound ways. This usually involves a considerable amount of help from livestock. Kelly studied ecological horticulture at UC Santa Cruz and holistic management with Alan Savory. He has been at Piscinas Ranch since 2014. The intention of the wine growing work he is doing there is to support flourishing ecosystem health, to create resiliency towards climate change, to improve profit potential, not to mention inspiring human participation and inspiration in this process. Welcome, Kelly. Welcome. Today on Tractor Time, I will be interviewing Kelly Mulville, who is the vineyard manager at Piscinas Ranch. Welcome, Kelly. Thanks for being here and taking some time to chat with me today.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to chat today about vineyard management and livestock integration in vineyards, and I think a little bit more broadly about sort of your vision about taking a different approach. So I'm excited to hear about that. Just to get started, do you mind sharing a little bit about yourself and your background and how you got to Piscinas?
Yeah, I grew up in El Paso, Texas, right on the border of New Mexico and Old Mexico. And our family had a little market farm, a very small one. It was mainly to keep me and my brothers out of trouble. And we sold vegetables just on a local kind of busy corner. All of my brothers did not like it, but I actually enjoyed it. But I was kind of, at an early age, got interested in organic farming because at an even earlier age, I was interested in falconry and raised a hawk when I was 11 years old. And after raising that hawk, my mom checked Silent Spring out of the library for me. And I just read like 10 pages of that when I was about, I don't know, 13 or 14. And it really, I joke that I've been depressed ever since. But it just, raising that bird really got me connected to the natural world, and in particular raptors. And when I learned that so many of them were in decline because of agricultural chemicals, that caused me to really want to be involved in something that would help them thrive instead of potentially make them extinct. So I spent a lot of time kind of trying to find whatever I could on organic farming and transitioned the little market garden into organic. And did that for a while until after high school, and then had a big crop failure one year. Ended up going to UC Santa Cruz to the Farm and Garden program, which was the only apprenticeship in organic agriculture at the time. And that was conveniently located next to the Peregrine Fund's Raptor Breeding Center for the West. And so I was gardening on one side of the fence and people were flying falcons on the other side of the fence. So it was about as close to utopia as I could get at the time. Anyway, so after leaving Santa Cruz, I ended up on a ranch at 9,000 feet at the headwaters of the Rio Grande and spent a number of years there. And a good friend of mine who I went to high school with, showed me an article on Alan Savory. So after my first year at that ranch, I rode my bike down to Savory's house, knocked on his door and asked how I could learn more about holistic management, because that really fit in line with his broader way of restoring ecosystems while kind of using agricultural animals and grazing to restore ecosystems. So I was pretty infatuated and fascinated with that process. Ended up working, kind of bouncing around between ranchers and doing farming for a while until I got interested in grape growing. And pretty quickly after getting interested in grape growing, I found myself on a small farm in southeastern Arizona in the Chiricahua Mountains. And I was managing an apple orchard there that needed to be, the trees were very old. So I talked the owners into putting in a vineyard there. And that's how I got into viticulture, not knowing anything about it. And it was kind of, that property was very remote. And it kind of just forced me to hunker down and figure out how to do this. And it was during that time that I kept thinking, well, seems like it'd be kind of easy to integrate animals into a vineyard. And I did bring in some neighbors' cattle when I was developing that site. And that was a total disaster. They broke through a 13-wire electric fence that I put up to keep out deer, javelina, jaguars, Cotamundis, ringtail cats, and all of the problem bears in Arizona were dropped off at that location. So my first adventure into integrating animals in a orchard were unsuccessful. The cattle broke through that fence and disappeared for about a week. So I kept on thinking about that idea and ended up having a couple of classes with a guy named Rob Rutherford, who was also studying holistic management, and he taught sheep science at Cal Poly. And so he gave me the rundown on what was going on with sheep. And I ended up kind of fast forwarding. I ended up, after putting in that vineyard, I ended up managing a couple of vineyards in California and built up a flock of sheep and were grazing vineyards during the winter time, but quickly realized that although that you could graze during the winter time, and that's a common thing to do, probably in places all over the world now, but it seemed like the best time of year to graze would actually be after the bud break of the vines. But the reason people don't do that is because sheep will eat the vines. And so I started developing a system. It was a pretty simple offset system using electrified wires on either side of the fruiting zone. And that allowed me to graze the vineyard at any time of the year. And after doing that trial, I wrote an article on that that was published in New Zealand and Australia and ended up going down there and doing some presentations and helping the first vineyard that I know of in the world get set up with that system. And so they've been doing that now for over 10 years, I think, using that electrified offset system. But when I came back, I was actually at the Quivira conference. And Sally Calhoun was there, who's the owner of Piscinus Ranch, which is where I'm at now. And a mutual friend of ours named Judy Earle, who's a range consultant in Australia. And Judy said that she just pulled me aside and said, "Hey, Sally Calhoun is here and she's interested in putting in a vineyard, but I told her not to do anything until she talked to you." So Sally and I met, and I was about to do a presentation a couple of weeks later at EcoFarm. And I just suggested that Sally come to that presentation and hear what I had to say, because I was, at that point, we are certified organic here, and I'm definitely a strong believer in organic practices in general. But I also believe that that's just a starting point. And so I told Sally I was not necessarily interested in just an organic vineyard, but I wanted to create something from the ground up, a design that allows us to graze at any time of the year, but also incorporated a number of other design elements that would make us more resilient to climate change and help increase biodiversity. And so we ended up with a long list of what we were trying to achieve. And so that's basically how I ended up here. As Sally said, okay, let's do it. And my wife and I were in, we were in Southern Colorado farming, actually in the San Luis Valley. And Sally got us at a weak moment during December when the high was 10 degrees below zero and talked us into coming out and doing this project. So that was about 9 years ago. And so I've been working on that ever since. That's how I got to where I'm at now.
That's a beautiful meandering story. And I feel like I have so many questions for you, but I'm not going to get into the literal and proverbial weeds quite yet. So you sort of mentioned how Sally presented this opportunity to test some things that you wanted to test. I'll mention that you have a article coming out in the June issue of Acres Magazine. And at the beginning of that article, I believe that you sort of talk about how there's a certain amount of systems thinking that you're doing in your approach to viticulture and how really to develop a climate resilient, regenerative model that we can't just sort of be doing small tweaks to existing systems, that there's some bigger creative design work type of thinking that has to happen. And so I'm curious if you can talk about that philosophically, and if you'd like, you can sort of tie it into what you're doing actually on the ground at Piscinas.
Okay. And this is definitely an evolving process for me. My dad was an architect, so I grew up with all kinds of things being designed, our house, our garden, our lives, you know, everything was designed. But they didn't always work out as one would hope. And that's where the kind of the power of holistic management really became obvious to me, is taking this broad perspective and looking at all these various elements. So you're looking at ecological, you're looking at social, you're looking at financial, spiritual. So all of these aspects need to be taken into consideration. And so by going through this process, and just by working with ranchers, a lot of whom had converted from being more conventional, traditional ranchers to using holistic plant grazing. And agriculture in general is a pretty conservative bunch of people. And I mean conservative, kind of just in their thinking. They like to hold on to traditions. And so there's a really good side to that. But sometimes our traditions are actually not favorable towards the ecosystem. And so, and I'd seen that in a lot of farming practices. And once you really start to understand the role of biodiversity in ecosystem health and the critical importance of ecosystem health to all life on the planet, including us, that in order to maintain civilization and health of all life, we really need to focus on the ecosystem health. And so that is a big part of the design here, is how can we actually restore ecosystem health and have agriculture at the same time? Because in general, and throughout the world, at least in kind of contemporary agriculture, it is one of the most destructive things that humans do. And we take a piece of land, for instance, and we clear it really of everything. And often that involves a lot of destruction to above ground life and below ground life as well, through tillage and leveling of land. And so we take what's taken years to develop through natural processes, you know, thousands, millions of years, and we reduce it to nothing in, you know, in a really quick time. And then we impose our idea of what we want and pretty much disregard everything else. And so I think that mentality and thinking is very wrong from an ecosystem perspective, but increasingly we're seeing that that is wrong from a just from an economical perspective, because so much, everything that nature does is based off of sunlight as the energy source. And so much of what we do in agriculture, we transition that to making our energy sources reliant on fossil fuels and extractive energy sources, and our fertility from extractive sources. And so we kind of eliminate this perfect system and pretend that we have something better. And so the trick now is, how do we actually work with nature and stay out of nature's way to allow it to function to the depth and complexity and intelligence that it is capable of, and farm in a way that really takes a lot less from us and kind of hand the driving wheel, the steering wheel back over to nature to let it do most of those things that we are putting incredible amounts of energy and effort and time and labor into stuff that is really kind of silly when you stand back and look at it from a perspective.
Do you want to talk a little bit about where the rubber meets the road? So how are you doing that at Piscinas?
I would say we have a lot of luck going with this. And I mean, it was a really incredible opportunity that someone said, let's try this out. I know that we'll make mistakes. And I'm referring to Sally Calhoun, the owner, but, as long as we can keep moving in a forward direction, then this should be pretty fun. And you know, we've definitely, this has not just been a like, yeah, let's just park the tractors and close the fertilizer accounts and see what happens. It's been kind of a somewhat slow process, and we've definitely had some speed bumps along the way. But basically what we did is to prepare the site, first off, we selected a site that the ecosystem was telling us was a good site to put perennials in. And in this climate, that means that because the historic average rainfall in this area is 12 inches, and we just went through 2 years of the worst drought in 1800 years, which has now been followed by one of the wettest years in recorded history. But so we definitely have that fluctuation in climate change. But in general, what you see in this landscape is that the perennials grow on the north-facing slopes, north or northish. It could be northeast or slightly northwest. But in general, that's where you'll see all the perennials. So I selected a hillside that faced to the north and already had a few perennials in the form of bushes on it. It had been farmed. There had been grapes in on this site for 30 years. It was part of one of the largest vineyards in the country. And that had been farmed very conventionally. So what we did is we just took that site and we smoothed down the squirrel holes, which should have been a big red flag for me. And we planted we put down a light compost application in the fall. And we're in a winter rain, Mediterranean climate. So we got the first rains. I think it was pretty close to average rainfall, and just whatever seed was in the ground is what germinated. We got 7 animal days per acre that first year. The second year, we did nothing but add a cover crop to that, and our carrying capacity went up tenfold. And we had 70 animal days per acre. And that was both years, that was just cattle. And so I think the big increase was due to the compost being assimilated into the soil and increasing the microbial activity, and then planting the cover crop as well. So the next year, we had even more animal days per acre because we included sheep in that mix. And that was the last year before we planted the vineyard. And so what we saw was actually a pretty fast progression in soil health by using biology to improve that soil health and using planned grazing, holistic planned grazing, and getting high stock density, good manure and urine deposition and density. And so we built up the site pretty well before we even planted the vineyard. So that was the initial way to do that. And then following that, once we planted the vineyard, we continued using cover crops and we continued grazing during the winter because we did design the vineyard so it could be grazed at any time of the year by using a high trellis system. But first off, we had to get the vines high enough so that we could graze at any time of the year. And so, for instance, we have a second planting that we've done, and those vines are 2 years old now. They're actually just 1 year old. Some of them are not even quite a year old. But so they're short. They could be, if the sheep got in there, they could eat everything down to the ground pretty quickly. So what we're doing is we're grazing during the winter until we can graze during the summer too. And now on the first planting, we're going into our third year of grazing that in the summer. And then, as in my previous trial of doing this on an existing vineyard, we are seeing a lot of benefits from that. And I think I'll quickly mention what those benefits are. We are monitoring our soil health, our soil biology, our bird species, our plant species, and our insects. Some of this we're doing ourselves, some of this others are doing, and some of it is kind of citizen science monitoring. So the way we're doing our birds is the vineyard is now an eBird hotspot. And so we're doing input. We're having people that come here and do input for what they're seeing. And so I think actually as of this week, I think we're pretty close to 70 species of birds that we've seen in the vineyard. And we are now at about probably neck to neck with our plant species too. And every year we see about an increase of 5 to 10 species of plants in the vineyard. And a lot of those are natives. And a lot of those occur during the summer. And this summer is going to be really fun to see because we've had double what we've had in the previous 2 years combined. So it's looking like a lot of interesting warm season stuff is already coming in. Insects, we weren't really sure what to do, so we ended up hiring an entomologist to do insect studies. And it's a comparative study between this vineyard and a neighboring vineyard, or maybe at least one neighboring vineyard, maybe two that are conventionally managed. And so we're seeing big differences in microbial population diversity and species and basically functional groups. For instance, we have a lot more microbes that do nutrient cycling and can live in undisturbed soil because we've never tilled. And the neighbors have a lot higher populations of microbes that can do well in tilled soil because they till. So, but overall, we have more species diversity. But it's really fascinating because we're working in conjunction with a company called Biome Makers. And so they are learning from this work what microbes are associated with various agricultural practices. So that's been pretty fascinating. And then the other thing that John Lundgren from Actisis told us to watch was our spider populations, because we can see those. We can see the spiders. We can see the spider webs. And we have so many spiders now that we had to put insect caps on all of our emitters because the young spiders, the small spiders, were using the emitters as habitat. And they were laying eggs in there too. And that was clogging our irrigation lines. So as we go through and put all the irrigation caps in, we have 15,000 irrigation caps we have to put in. It's actually one of those tasks that I'm grateful for because it's, again, an indicator that we're on the right track. The plants, we're doing a lot of the plants ourselves, but we also have people that come in who know their plants. And a neighbor of ours is the plant ecologist at Pinnacles National Park. And she likes coming out here occasionally and just helping us ID plants and seeing what's going on here. So it's kind of a community effort, the monitoring that occurs here.
This December, why not join the Acres USA community in Covington, Kentucky for our 48th annual EcoAg Conference and Trade Show. This exciting event brings together the leading voices in regenerative agriculture to offer practical advice based on personal experience and well-developed expertise. Each moment of programming is thoughtfully curated to provide practical, useful, and measurable information that you can apply to your operation. Our workshops and plenary sessions are led by experienced producers like John Kempf, Will Harris, Gary Zimmer, Mark Shepard, Reginaldo Haslett-Marroquin, Laura Kavanaugh, and many other innovative leaders working in the field. The week kicks off on Monday morning, December 4th, with three different incredible full-day EcoAg University intensive workshops to choose from, and our conference and trade show opens with a reception on the evening of Tuesday, December 5th, followed on Wednesday and Thursday by the conference program of 1 to 2 hour sessions and amazing keynotes. Dig into subjects like soil health, farm management, livestock integration, and more, or hop between them all as you spend time absorbing new information, making new connections and discoveries every day. Join us for the main conference and trade show, or decide to come early for the intensive EcoAg University. Either way, you can expect a fulfilling experience that will include exceptional learning from experienced growers and agronomists who have learned valuable lessons and are ready to share. For more information and to register, please go to our website, www.acresusa.com. See you in Covington.
Are you looking for the next bestseller for your favorite farmer or gardener? Visit the Acres USA bookstore to find the perfect gift for any loved one who likes getting their hands dirty. Find titles from great authors and farmers like Elliot Coleman, Mark Shepard, Andre Liu, and others. Get 20% off any Acres bookstore purchase with the discount code TT20. Before I sort of dive into some specifics, can you let the audience know sort of what is the size and scale of the operation, both maybe in terms of livestock and in terms of acreage, just to kind of get a sense? I think it'll help contextualize some of your comments about monitoring and those types of things.
Right. Well, first, on the broad scale, Piscinas Ranch is 7,600 acres. 600 acres of that is irrigated cropland, and the rest is rangeland. And then we have 25 acres of the vineyard. That's I think I'd mentioned that it's in a site that was previously in vineyards as well. And the majority of the ranch is actually managed with livestock. So we run cattle, and it used to be a lot of cattle, mainly cattle, and now we're mainly sheep. It turns out that sheep tend to do better in this ecosystem and climate than cattle do, and vegetation as well. So right now we have probably a little over 3,000 sheep on the ranch, and they're all hair sheep, so they lose their wool in the summer, and that most of those get sold for meat. We harvest some and sell our own. We sell sheep, turkeys, chicken, and pork, all from animals that are raised on the ranch. And the pigs are raised on some of the irrigated land, and the sheep run on some of the irrigated land as well, which has forage growing in it. And again, the vineyard is 25 acres. That was divided into two sections. The first planting was 2017, and the second planting was last year. And we have 17 different varieties of grapes, all chosen because they do well in hot climates.
Backing up just a little bit, you've mentioned a couple of times about how you sort of had this moment of epiphany, realizing that a lot of folks who were grazing in vineyards were doing it in the winter because of concern about how they were going to impact the plants during the growing season. How did you learn that grazing animals during the growing season is a good idea, and sort of what's the difference there? Can you get into the literal weeds about having sheep or some type of grazer in the vineyard during the growing season?
So the I'd mentioned earlier that offset system that I developed, which is very simple. It's just one electric wire on either side of the fruiting zone, extending out about 9 inches on either side of the trellis. And so if you're going to just imagine your grapevine is kind of a hedge, and then right below that hedge, it's like a, you know, you have this trunk going up, then you have this hedge above the ground, and then you have this hot wire on either side of that hedge, and that keeps the sheep from browsing the fruit and the canopy. And when I did that trial, I wasn't really sure what would happen, but it was one of the few things that was successful the first time I tried it. And there's a very small vineyard that I was managing for a friend, and it was being managed both biodynamically and organically. And so what happened was that allowed that we didn't have to do any mowing or weed eating. We didn't have to do any suckering because the vine stalks, the trunks, will get leaves and shoots growing on it. And those need to be removed because they're lower on the vine, they will rob energy from the vine, energy and water, and not allow it to get up into the canopy and the fruit. And so those, usually several times a year, a crew will come through and remove those by hand. There are machines that can do that now as well. They're kind of rough on the vines. So it eliminated that suckering, and it also eliminated the shoot tipping. So when the vines get long enough, the shoots come, they grow up, and then they start getting weighted down, and they hang down into the rows. And the sheep would just come along and trim those as soon as they could reach them. So, and then we were able to eliminate offsite fertility as well, because they're converting the suckers, they're converting all the vegetation that's growing on the vineyard floor into dung and urine. And they're doing that, and this is especially important, they're doing that during the growing season of the vine. And so, for instance, they're peeing in the vine during the growing season, I think is pretty important, because the majority of nutrients in waste from a mammal is in the urine, and it's in a more readily available form to plants. So we're getting that onto the plants during the growing season, and I think that's one of the reasons why the need for outside fertility is reduced greatly. So after I did that trial in that vineyard, I was working with a winemaker who was from the Napa area and kind of a famous old school winemaker. And he also taught winemaking at Napa College. And at the end of that trial, we were just talking about what had occurred, and he suggested I write an article. And that's the one that ended up in New Zealand, Australia, New Zealand Grape Grower Winemaker. And it also ended up in Stockman Grass Farmer and Acres, kind of a less technical version. And so so in addition to everything that I mentioned, we looked at the economic savings, and at that time it amounted to anywhere between $500 and $1,000 an acre in savings between eliminating tractor use, fossil fuel, labor, fertility inputs. And one of the big surprises was that we had a 90% decrease in irrigation use compared to the control site. We had a big control site on the other side because it was a small vineyard that had been taken out of a much larger vineyard. And so we had a built-in control site, and we had a 90% reduction in irrigation use, and we had about a 1,300 pound increase in yield, 1,300 pound per acre increase in yield. And so that was a big eye-opener for myself and George, the winemaker. And we're like, God, what's going on there? And so that's one of the reasons why I was really inspired. Okay, let's do this and start looking at what are all the other things we could actually design for, and what are the benefits that are probably going to be unknown to us that we might realize from that. And so that's, I actually kind of, thanks for coming back to this, because it kind of jumped forward to what we were discovering here. But I had no idea about that we would increase bird numbers, and we still really didn't have good ways of knowing what was going on in the soil back then. So it's, but it's a continual learning process. And it's also a continual process of figuring out how do we monitor what's going on in an economically viable way, and also in a way that's meaningful for management and just knowing what we're doing.
That's a perfect segue to my next set of questions. So it's so amazing, the sort of transformation in terms of labor and inputs that you discovered through animal integration. And, you know, it sounds like on the flip side that you've created other types of work for yourself based on what you said about the spiders earlier. Yeah. So it seems like there's definitely a trade-off there. And also, as you were listing all of the different types of monitoring you're doing, clearly that takes time and energy and a certain amount of labor. And then as I was looking at your article, I did notice the increase in bird population, which is really wonderful. I know that a lot of wine growers are concerned about birds. I mean, birds impact harvest rates, right? They're out there eating the grapes. So that's like a very specific kind of a question. But in terms of the biodiversity, I think that it's clear that it brings a ton of benefits. But I think from a maybe like economic production standpoint, there might be folks who look at that and they're like, I don't know, I'm unsure. Can you kind of speak to some of those factors and how you just strike a balance between all of those things?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the way that we're doing it right now is that, so the food sources for birds are obviously, fruit can be a food source, and insects and seeds are probably, you know, three of the main things that the birds will eat. So right now we have, we don't have any fruit. And all of the birds that are in the vineyard are insect eaters, or they're predators. They're eating other birds or rodents and things like that. So, and we have also put up bird boxes. We have tree swallows and bluebirds that nest in the vineyard. And so it's so all of those birds that I mentioned are insect or seed eaters, and everything that's in the vineyard right now are insect eaters. And the largest population of birds we had last year were tricolored blackbirds, which is a native endemic species to California and southern Oregon. And it's also incredibly endangered. And we ended up having a population of about 800 in the vineyard last year. And that was the according to the wildlife biologists, and there were a lot of wildlife biologists here last year because that bird was here, that's because we had such a large insect population. And, you know, if you keep in mind that the majority of insects, like 99%, are beneficial or at least not harmful, then it's great to have a lot of insects. And so the problem arises when your fruit starts to ripen and the birds get onto that. And so we've been reducing the bird pressure by using cannons, and we used one of those, they call it an air dancer. You see it like used car lots. It's a fan blowing this like big goofy structure around. And we used one of those, and we also used these pop guns that would send a flare up and a pop into the air. And, but we've done that for a couple of years. And last year we realized that we're going to need to use nets. So, we put up netting last year, and this year we'll be netting everything. So that's how we deal with that. We actually just make that fruit unavailable to the fruit eating birds. And we encourage as many insect eaters and predator birds as well. We've got a lot of falcons that hang around here on their own, so that's helpful.
I'm wondering if you could spend a little bit of time talking about the the economics. So we've talked a little bit about sort of some of the almost like the economics of the ecology, I guess, or sort of some of the cost benefit trade-offs that you've explored. I'm wondering if you can talk more specifically about just the dollars and cents of it.
Yeah. And I know that for Acres readers and followers of this podcast, there's probably a lot of people doing something other than wine or wine growing. And if for instance, and I gave the figures on the cost savings for wine growers, which is probably easily in the $1,000 per acre range, and that is not including if you've developed another enterprise, which we have, which is actually selling those sheep. For instance, when I was doing the trial, I would just buy sheep in around Christmas time or so, run them in the vineyard until it was time to move them out, until the vines were about to bud out. And then, I would, harvest those and put them in my freezer. But, so it was kind of like, I was fattening them and turning them into food for myself. So there's a number of ways people could go about this. And it depends on how much cost savings you're going to get. And that a big factor in that is whether you have your own flock of sheep and can run them in the vineyard or orchard or whatever it might be. And they are also another income producer, or if it's something that you might be leasing or renting and paying for, which is obviously going to reduce the amount of savings that you might have, but I think you can still do that profitably. And there are people that are paying other people to graze their animals in their vineyards or orchards or farms. So there's got to be either an economic or an economical benefit for that, for people to do that. So as I mentioned, we're doing things the way that nature does it, which is the fertility comes from the cycling of nutrients, not the hauling off of nutrients. And it allows us to keep forage plants, just a wide diversity of plants growing in the vineyard throughout the year. And that allows the capture of sunlight and converting that into energy and carbon and cycling that carbon into the ground, building up the water holding capacity. And so I think that all of those things, and I already mentioned the reductions in irrigation use. So reducing irrigation use, reducing fertility inputs, reducing labor. And you did make a good point. You also are shifting labor around. For instance, we're not doing any tillage. We're not doing any mowing once the vines are mature. We're not doing any herbicides or anything like that. We are certified organic, but they do make organic herbicides, but we're not using any of that. So the amount of tractor time, no pun intended, goes down greatly with doing something like this. The only time we actually take a tractor into the vineyard is when we do our sprays, which is about 6 to 8 times a year. Otherwise, we have no need to take the tractor in. So it's basically the savings, the economics of this comes from two things. One is reducing costs by dramatically reducing inputs, and the other is by developing another enterprise. And so those are the two main ways that we're getting our cost savings.
This episode is also brought to you by the Regenerate Conference. Each year, the Kavira Coalition, Holistic Management International, and the American Grass-Fed Association collaborate to convene ranchers, farmers, conservationists, land managers, scientists, and thought leaders to share knowledge, build community, and create a culture of resilience and regeneration. Join us this year, November 1st through 3rd in Santa Fe, to explore regenerative agriculture at every scale, from microbial soil communities to social relationships and markets, to our changing climate and everything in between. Learn more and get registered today at regenerateconference.com. Are you passionate about sustainable agriculture and gardening? Then visit the Acres USA bookstore today. They have the best selection of books on sustainable agriculture and gardening from leading authors like Elliot Coleman, Mark Shepard, Andre Liu, and others. Get 20% off any Acres book purchase today with the discount code T20. Shop bookstore.acresusa.com and support sustainable agriculture. I know. So I have recently also interviewed Harry Green at Propagate, which is an agroforestry company. One of the things we talked about there are sort of partnerships and how there's sort of two ways to approach enterprises, right? To have multiple enterprises of your own or to do partnerships. And I know one of the ways that you all are partnering is that you're working with a winemaker. You're not making wine yourself out of these grapes. I'm curious if you would want to spend a little time talking about what that partnership looks like. Are there some mutual social benefits there? And if you want to go into it, talk specifically about the types of wine that are being made.
Sure. So the as of right now, there's not a winery at Piscinas Ranch. And one our initial thinking was to just find a winemaker to contract with, just one winemaker, and we'd grow what they wanted to a certain sense. They kind of needed to fall under. And we have a big list of stuff that we would consider. But what that didn't happen, and we just decided to go ahead and plant a diversity of things and probably gear our market more towards some of the younger folks that are trying to get away from the main grape varieties that are grown in California, like Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot and probably Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc are the big whites. And Pinot Noir is increasingly getting popular. But it's when people realize that there's over 2,000 named grape varieties there, and especially young people, like, well, let's try some of the others. And I've always been interested, since I first got into wine, I've been interested in some of the outliers. And there's some really fabulous stuff out there. And there are people that are kind of building their wineries based on interesting wines and really promoting how those wines are being grown too. So we kind of found a young woman nearby who was looking for grapes that we decided to work with initially, and we are still working with her. And her company is called Margins Wine. And we are also working with one of her partners in her facility who has a winery called Flores Wines. And they are between, so Flores has just made a Pique Poule Blanc, which is a white variety. And Margins, Megan Bell, has made a Grenache, a Assyrtiko, and a Verdejo. Grenache is actually one of the more common varieties that we grow. There's other people in California growing that for sure. And it's pretty common. It's one of the more common ones in the world, but it's still not that common in California. In addition, the Verdejo is from, Spain, and the Assyrtiko is from Greece. It's from the Greek island of Santorini. And that one is a really rare one. And Megan has sold out of all of the wines that she makes from here within like a month or two of releasing them. So they're working really well for her. And this is the first year we'll have wines from two other winemakers, Flores, who I just mentioned, and another woman named Tara Bajli, and her label is called Tara Wines. And she made a Syrah Grenache rosé, and she also made a Verdejo from here. And then we have one other winemaker that we work with, and she's a little bit more established. And in fact, she recently was voted one of the top 100 wineries in the world by Wine and Spirits magazine, I believe. And her wine label is called A Tribute to Grace, and she only makes Grenache. And so she's making a Grenache from here too. And I should mention what else we have planted here, because we have 17 varieties. And that, so it includes everything I've mentioned, but also we have Grenache Gris, which is kind of a gray or rosé type grape. And we have Grenache Blanc, which is white. We also have Cinsault, Carignan, Cabernet Sauvignon, Cunois, Menthia, Syrah, Fiano, Muscat Blanc, Chile Aggiolo, Barbera, and Nero d'Avola.
So all of those other varieties, where do they go?
Well, they're all planted now. And we usually, I've gotten to the point where I try and have an acre, at least an acre of each one. So, and we have 25 acres, so some of those get a little bit more than an acre. And some of them get a little bit less. But, and we it's at least a full row. We don't like divide a row between varieties. And all of the, and it's quite possible that maybe some of those won't work out that well with our particular training system. But in general, I think most of them will do fine.
That's great. So it sounds like part of it is just being able to demonstrate what works well with this, or understanding better what varieties might work well with this particular type of system.
And that is part of our strategy here. It's we're learning, and we also want to be a little bit adventurous in what we try out and be realistic about that the climate is changing and people are starting to look at different varieties. And some of them make some really interesting wines. And so we're trying to capitalize off the fact that we're growing some stuff that other people aren't growing, and that it is that is becoming more sought after. But we're also demonstrating that you can grow it here, and that it will do as well or perhaps even better than some of the stuff that has been the backbone of California wine.
That's great. I have one sort of like bigger philosophical question that I'd love to ask you, but is there anything else about your particular production method that comes to mind that I didn't ask you about that you'd like to share?
I just wanted to mention that our trellis is a high trellis system. And when I got this job, I actually wasn't sure what trellis system I would use. And I thought I might do a complete overhead system. But this trellis system was developed in Texas by a guy named Jerry Watson. And a friend of mine, I saw him show a slide on it, and I'd never seen it before. And I called him up and said, "Hey, that looks like it might work really well for grazing." And he said, "Well, I work with everybody in the country who's using that system, and I can tell you nobody's grazing under it. So you'd be the first." So the vineyard, it's not like everything we're doing here is brand new. And there's definitely vineyards in Spain and Portugal and probably other parts of the New World, Italy, that were trained overhead and quite likely were grazed during the summer as well because they were trained overhead. But so it's a divided canopy and it's a partial overhead. So the rows are 12 feet apart. And when the vines are in full production, they cover about probably 75% of everything. So you're working in the shade. The sheep are in the shade in the summer, which is great. And it helps keep the fruit color cooler. It helps keep the ground cooler. And it mitigates the fact that things are getting warmer.
That's great. Does it do anything in terms of like maturation of the grapes and when they're sort of hitting that literal sweet spot?
It probably does have a slight effect on that. The other thing, so it's probably affecting, I think it's affecting fruit quality and time of ripeness. But, and really the only way to fairly test that would be, there's a few variety of those varieties that we're growing, like the Grenache that some neighbors are growing. I could compare, Brix readings with them, which is a good idea. I think I will try and do that and see if we're getting that much additional time on the vine because we have a little bit more shading. But the other thing that is happening is that the trellis is high, the drip line is high, so that means the sheep can go in any direction, and that means we can go in any direction too. So normally in a vineyard, you're kind of limited unless you crawl under the vines to being in that row. And that's especially true for sheep, that oftentimes they can't get between rows, which can be problematic for them because that might limit them to like a 6 foot wide row, which I think can be kind of claustrophobic. We can walk in any direction under there. And even though it's, you know, from the air, it still is a row. It looks linear. Effectively, you have access anywhere underneath that, either on foot or hooves, whatever the case may be.
That's great. As part of taking over being the host of this podcast, I've been trying to come up with like sort of a big question that I can ask all of my guests. And I'm testing out the question, which is, what is the ecological role of the farmer? And it sounds like, you know, you're somebody who's thought a lot about all of the different facets of the ecology of viticulture. I'm curious how you respond to that question.
Well, unfortunately, I think as farmers, and I, you know, I started out as a kid, you know, using pesticides and herbicides and stuff, because I just thought that's how you did it. And that's what my, you know, my dad said, here, go put out the whatever, because we got some bugs. And I think that increasingly the role of the farmer is going to be a lot more fun. And really it's going to be more the role of a person doing restoration. And I think that can sound kind of arrogant, because really what the role is allowing nature to recover. And nature is the one that's going to be doing most of the work. It's kind of trying to understand where you can fit in and effectively help nature without messing things up. And as humans, we're really good at messing things up. And so it's kind of being aware, paying attention, and being humble and realizing that our understanding is a molecule in a universe compared to nature. And that what we really need to do is just quit messing up nature and allow nature to return. And I think nature is happy to allow us to do things that we want within reason. And the more that we allow the natural world to express itself, I think the better it gets for us and what we're trying to achieve. For me, I mean, I wish I was at the point that I'm at now when I was like a 10-year-old kid. And just realizing that it's not about fighting the natural world. It's not about controlling. It's not about dominating. It's about nurturing and staying out of the way and allowing something greater than yourself to express itself.
That's great. That's really beautiful, Kelly. Thank you. So sort of to wrap things up, there are two things I'd love to ask you to share. One is, do you have recommended reading or listening for our guests to learn more on this particular topic? It could be something that you've written, but also could be things that you're reading or listening to.
So one of the things I'm reading right now is Fred Provenza's book, which is called Nourish. And that is really fascinating. And that's a great segue from what I was just talking about, because Fred is one of those guys who's paid attention to what the natural world is saying and how what we can learn from grazing animals about the natural world. And so that's a good one. And which also leads me to, I think, one of the best things that people can do is actually just take time to be in nature and just watch things. I mean, even just watching a sheep graze for a while is fascinating, because they are, and that kind of goes back to Fred's book too, it's the thinking that's going on, because some of the stuff that they're eating can be toxic in large amounts, but it can be medicinal in small amounts. And one sheep may eat it, but the other won't. And the amount of stuff that's happening out there with grazing animals is just phenomenal. And paying attention to what the birds are doing, what the birds are eating, and just kind of quietly being in nature and observing and getting used to doing that and getting good at doing that. And kind of to back up everything I've read from Andre Voisin has been fabulous. And it's in that same vein of a scientist who spent a lot of time in nature watching grazing animals and really paying attention to the dynamics between the surface of the earth and these animals that are intimately involved with what's happening there. And of course, one of the first things that the first books that I read in the area of restoration was Alan Savory, Holistic Management. And I still like to reread that occasionally and always learn something new. Those are some of the main things I've been reading lately. But also another one that I read that was really fascinating was the, I'm going to forget the title of it, but it's a book, it's an ethnobotany book on Native Californians. And I can get the name of that to you for the notes. I really enjoy reading ethnobotany books and learning about how previous cultures were interacting with the land. And because oftentimes it's not just through farming, but it is through kind of assisting trees and plants into providing things that you're interested in and protecting them. So it's those are pretty fascinating accounts and examples of paying attention to nature and learning from nature.
That's great. I love the idea of paying attention to your nature feed, you know, like rather than your social media feed going out.
Right. Exactly.
Tuning in there. That's wonderful. I think that's fabulous advice.
That's a really good way to put it too. Put down your phone and
pick up your nature feed.
Pick up your nature feed. It's free.
Yeah, exactly. It's not going to take, it may take your data in a different way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Kelly, thank you so much for joining us. Also, would you like to share any details about where to find out more about your work?
Sure. You can go to piscinusranch.com, and that's spelled P-A-I-C-I-N-E-S. And if you go under our work on that website, you'll find the vineyard. And under the vineyard, there's a lot of resources. There's other interviews that I've done and articles. And so that's a pretty good place to start. And we like to keep the information on that pretty current and add things as they come. So we're trying to make that a good resource for others.
Well, that's wonderful. Kelly, thank you so much for joining me today. Before we sign off, do you have any last thoughts you'd like to share with our audience?
No, I just would like to thank you for doing this. And I really appreciate it, actually everything that Acres is doing. And I've been following Acres since it was kind of almost just like a newspaper that came out years ago. But yeah, there's a lot of good information. And I would also just like to mention that the work we're doing, we by no means feel like we're experts in this. We are learning a lot. And I think that the most important thing is to have a lot of people on the land paying attention and using their imagination, because as Einstein said, imagination is actually a lot more important than knowledge. And so I think that we need to spend a lot more time learning from nature and imagining what is possible to get ourselves out of this mess that we've gotten ourselves into.
That's great. That's a perfect point to end on. Kelly, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you for listening to Tractor Time, a podcast production of Acres USA. Find us on Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, and other popular podcast platforms. Find other Acres USA media and learn about Acres events at acresusa.com. We'd like to thank Acres USA staff for their contributions to producing this podcast. This episode was edited and engineered by Brad Parsons of Train Sound Studio. And we're grateful to our guests for taking the time to talk with us about their experiences. Today's episode was sponsored by C90 Ocean Minerals, the first step in regenerative agriculture. Remember, the fall is the best time to enhance soil fertility for next season. Learn how at c-90.com or give them a call at 717-580-1458.